Can we assume that your work is almost like research, like a survey, as opposed to just a real-life experience?
Absolutely, absolutely. I stress data collection. You've got to get the hard data. A lot of the problems today is a lot of groups are going out with handheld equipment, and the data is transitory, meaning they read something on a dial or on a meter, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
There's no permanent record of it, and all you have left is their word or their report, which is a secondhand account of what that data was. In science, that's a weak data. It's not really doesn't really have a lot of weight. We call it anecdotal data. What we need is hardcore mapped out data coming from software, such as data loggers and that sort of thing, that give us a real-time running code of all the different conditions we're monitoring and how the actual event that takes place affects those readings, and to look for a correlation between that. And that's something I preach pretty heavily throughout the book, that there's no one single piece of evidence that really proves anything. In fact, one piece of evidence is pretty meaningless until you put it into the big picture with the rest of the evidence so that it builds a picture. It's like forensics a lot, where you go to a crime scene and you pick up little minute pieces of information and build a whole story from it. This is very much like that, where we go in and we pick up bits and pieces of data and put it into some kind of order to see if anything shakes loose from it, see if there's a relationship. And slowly but surely, as we're getting more higher tech in our approach, we're starting to find those correlations, and it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's an exciting time for me.
That is exciting. And are you convinced, first of all, then, that weather anomalies or inversions of temperature has something to do with it? Will show that there's some kind of spiritual involvement here?
Well, I think it's certainly these environmental changes are byproducts of the effect it's having on our environment. Absolutely.
All right. Now let's talk a little about EMF. How important is that in your study?
I think EMF is really what my study of EMF in these environments is really what opened up this whole vista of what's really going on here. I started studying a relationship between electromagnetic fields and EVP several years ago and designed a couple of pieces of equipment to monitor it, to compare the EMF background waves to what was being recorded as audio on a recorder. And we started to find that they matched. And we did a series of experiments that pretty well demonstrated that electronic voice phenomena was being created by electromagnetic waves in the voice spectrum, not sound, but electromagnetic waves. Further experiments with some new equipment we recently designed has shown that this EMF seems to be emerging into the environment, meaning it's coming like in thin air from no apparent source, which opens up this whole new vista of possibilities. So when these things start occurring, we throw everything we have at that small localized area of effect to try to map out exactly what's going on. And we've discovered some pretty interesting things.
Like?
One of the things we've noticed is that ion counts dramatically increase. Now, a lot of people discount measuring ions because most ion counters are not that accurate. They run about, for a really good one, they're about 5% accurate. But we're not looking at exact counts. We're looking at ratios of increase.
Right.
So if you have a normal background ion count of, say, you know, 150 parts, and it suddenly goes up to 7,000 parts, something very dramatic has just ionized a whole bunch of air.
Something's happened, or the equipment's not working right.
Right. So we correlated that with increases in radiation. We were getting these gamma radiation spikes, again, in a very localized area, you know, like in someone's living room. Now, normally you don't have gamma radiation spikes in your living room, unless you live, you know, on top of a pile of uranium or something. But these were not steady, you know, decay rates. They were bursts, much like an annihilation was occurring. A subatomic annihilation was occurring, giving out these bursts of gamma radiation. Now, we experimented with a lot of different things to block out cosmic ray interference and things of this nature, you know, using some lead shielding and things like that. And it comes out that all of this stuff is going on pretty much in a very small area where people experience something weird happening to them.
Well, these, and I was going to ask you this, David, do these ghosts have to be in the region you're in for you to study it?
They may not even be in our region at all.
That's what I was going to say. Could they be in a multiverse? Could they be who knows where?
Absolutely. In fact, what my theory has been developing now that we're actually dealing with a type of wormhole that opens up, connects our universe. And this is heavy stuff, and people are probably going to poo-poo me and everything, but I believe an adjacent universe to our own connects with our universe. And the act of that connection dramatically alters the environment around it to the point where we get temperature shifts, barometric pressure drops due to differentials in barometric pressure. And I also believe that we may not be seeing a ghost, but instead may be seeing the reflection of the consciousness, pure energy on a holographic boundary of a wormhole.
Would that be the same as the soul?
You could call it that. I like to call it consciousness because I think we are on the cusp of discovering some pretty key things about our consciousness, that we are based on pure energy.
Let's assume for a moment when one dies, this consciousness goes into a different plane, which is, let's say, another universe. And somehow this tunnel that everybody says they see, this tunnel of light,
absolutely,
maybe they're going through this wormhole.
Absolutely. That's exactly what got me to looking at this in the first place, was studying NDE accounts, you know, from people who had died, literally died, and was dead for 8 or 10 minutes, and experienced these feelings or these visions or whatever you would like to classify them as. And I started thinking, you know, this sounds an awful lot like a potential wormhole situation.
Exactly.
What if that's what it is? What if that's what it is? Then I set out to try to figure out how to prove that. That's another whole ball game, but we have some promising results. I mean, we are finding time anomalies occurring in these areas. We are finding, like I say, radiation, which would be indicative of particle annihilation. And, of course, in physics, to keep a wormhole stable, you need something called exotic matter, which is matter with a negative mass. And when it comes into contact with our matter, there's going to be subatomic annihilations. Which is interesting, because if we had atomic annihilations, we'd have huge craters in people's homes.
Yeah, that's true. But let's say one dies, the wormholes open up automatically upon death, for whatever reason.
Right.
You know, we don't know these things yet.
No, we don't. We have no clue what starts them.
But some of them go through it, some of them don't.
That's correct.
That is fascinating.
We can assume that there may be some that radiate in a region as energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that energy can be neither created nor destroyed. So all of those synapses firing our brain that are all EM fields inside our body, when we die, they flee the body. They radiate outwards. Now, the big question is do we maintain the totality of ourself and have our awareness when that flees? And the anecdotal evidence certainly seems to suggest that we do.